From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As we continue our look back at 2016, we speak today with Mark Sloboda, Senior Lecturer in International Relations at Moscow State University, about the condition of U.S.-Russian relations over the past year. Mark, Happy New Year. It's been too long. I guess we should start with a little history of the chessboard that's been being played over the year between the U.S. and Russia.
The history of Russian relations and the Obama administration is a complicated one. Early in the administration, there was an attempt to reset relations between Russia and the U.S. And this came on the heels of the Iraq War under George Bush. And then we had color revolutions, the first Orange Revolution in Ukraine and the Rose Revolution in Georgia. And then the August War, when the U.S.-backed neoliberal strongman Saakashvili in Georgia, a protege of the neocon John McCain, I mean, someone literally, you know, raised up, noticed from abroad, and then McCain helped raise him up to a position of power in Georgia. Right. He came to power in the Rose Revolution. Proceeded to reorientate Georgia towards the United States, instituted a whole lot of neoliberal shock therapy policies, which would eventually help lead to his downfall at the hands of his own people.
Right.
But then launched a campaign to militarily retake two long-held ethnic minority separatist regions in South Ossetia and Abkhazia that had earlier been placed essentially into the status of a frozen conflict with peacekeepers from across the former Soviet Union, the Commonwealth of Independent States, which of course is dominated by Russia. But this had earlier been agreed to by the previous Georgian administrations, because it was, you know, the best they could do at the time. The Georgian military had not fared well. There was a high degree of ethnic nationalism, and the conflicts had started under the cries of previous Georgian presidents as Georgia for Georgians, to which the Ossetians and the Abkhazians took a little bit of, I think, warranted exception. But these two provinces had actually separated before the final breakup of the Soviet Union, and they had done so under the auspices of the Soviet Constitution, which, while certainly is not on much on anyone's minds today, they regarded as having some legitimacy. And, you know, these two were locked into a frozen conflict for a long period of time, and Saakashvili attempted to retake them by force. And certainly part of the rationale is he realized that it would be very difficult for him to join NATO without having these regions under his firm control, because of the provisions, territorial provisions, and the inability of NATO to accept a member that doesn't have full control over territory it claims, and so on. This failed badly because Russia immediately intervened. They had peacekeepers on the ground when the Georgian troops attacked, and I think we can safely assume that they had U.S. Special Forces help at the time, and George Bush was president. Russian peacekeepers and peacekeepers from other members of states of the former Soviet Union were killed. Russia came in hard and fast, and they drove the Georgian forces completely out of these two breakaway provinces. They proceeded to do a small incursion into Georgia proper, in order to degrade Georgia's military as it is, give them a slap on the wrist, teach them a lesson, make sure there would be no follow-up attacks. And then they withdrew back, to more or less the borders of these two separatist regions, which they then proclaimed independent states as a way of raising the middle finger at the United States, who they saw, I believe rightly, as behind all of this. This was this in Georgia and the Orange Revolution, which failed and led to the election of the then President Yanukovych in Ukraine. This really set off relations between Russia and the U.S. to a really bad start. Obama, when he came into office, to his credit, did try this reset. But right from the beginning, with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, they actually used the wrong word for reset when they handed Lavrov a button that in Russian said overload.
Oh, God. You know, I don't think Americans have a full appreciation when you talk about ethnic tensions in that region of the links between the various nationalities. For example, the big demon of the Soviet Union, particularly in the eyes of the what they call the left in the United States, that they think of as the evil Russian dictator, Joseph Stalin, was actually Georgian, for example. He was
the head of the Soviet Union. Absolutely. And Joseph Stalin is still revered in Georgia today, you know, much to the chagrin, of course, of a lot of people that dreamt of seeing Georgia restored to the U.S. orbit. He still is. And Georgia still has politics today, strongly orthodox, very social conservative, that are really, really much closer to Russia. And when Saakashvili was eventually driven out of office, he lost in an election. He lost overwhelmingly. His party has not been able to regain traction since. He was accused of corruption, of abuse of power. And you know, perhaps most damningly, what helped bring, you know, down a campaign, he was locking up his political opponents. I mean, and you know, the press doesn't want to talk about this. You know, he was putting down protests against him violently as unemployment roared huge because of the neoliberal shock therapy and so on. But not only was he locking them up, but his political prisoners were being sodomized in prison. And photos of the submerged, and it's pretty much undeniable. So he left under a pallor of shame, fled the country.
Yeah, left the jurisdiction. When you say he left the jurisdiction.
He took up in Brooklyn, setting himself up as a hipster in Brooklyn. And there's a lot of rather humorous photos of him trying to fit in with the hipsters in Brooklyn. It's rather amusing. And then within a few years, he was trotted out, you know, as a reliable anti-Russian. And he was installed by the new Ukrainian regime installed during the second color revolution there, the Maidan revolution that's still in power. He was installed as the governor of Odessa, a area that doesn't really like him very much because Odessa is a largely pro-Russian region of Ukraine, you know, by and large, you know, generalities we're speaking. And he proceeded with the neoliberal shock therapy and as well. And recently he's been cast out as governor of Odessa there as well. And now having become a Ukrainian citizen, still a fugitive from U.S. justice, I mean, from Georgian justice, which the Western press will never, ever admit. In their puff pieces on Saakashvili, they cast him as an anti-corruption crusader and so on. Never once mentioning that he's wanted, for corruption and abuse of power charges in his own country by his own people. They just block all this stuff. This is despite the fact that the new Georgian administration, while undoubtedly not hostile to Russia like Saakashvili was, still wants to orientate Georgia towards the West, trade-wise, and is still, you know, pushing, however much lighter for NATO membership, probably much more intelligent. They've had trade restorations improved with Russia, you know, especially the wine and the sparkling water, which is big. You know, Russia was huge for their business. It's not like they're a pro-Russian puppet state there. The U.S. continues to do business and sell and give them military aid. But they will never admit that Saakashvili, you know, their great neoliberal protege, is actually wanted in that country. So now he's creating a whole new mess in Ukraine for the Maidan regime there. And I imagine in Moscow, they're just, you know, passing the popcorn box back and forth.
Just watching what happens.
Laughing at it. So this was a big, this reset broke apart with the 2000 use of the UN Security Council resolution to overthrow the government of Libya when it had been very specifically just for humanitarian reasons, which right. China and Russia angrily spoke out against. Right. This is when Putin decided to return to power because he realized at that point that the U.S. can't be trusted. And then this Maidan putsch in Ukraine, while Russia was, I believe, somewhat naively focused on the Olympics. They took their eye off the ball and they had a misplaced faith in the strength of the Yanukovych government, which, while democratically elected, he tried to rule to the west half of the country and actually pushed for Ukraine's admittance with this EU association agreement himself, thus alienating his own base in the east of the country, but not satisfying the west of the country. And when at the last moment, when presented with this 1,500-page neoliberal shock therapy diktat, and he said, "What? You're not giving me any money to help soften the blow for the millions of my people that are going to be unemployed from their state jobs and so on?" And your EU's like, "No."
Right.
And you're not going to allow anything for us to maintain our existing free trade agreements with Russia and the rest of the Commonwealth of Independence, the states. And the EU said, "No, we're not. You can't have anything to do with them if you're having to do with us." Right. And Yanukovych said, "Well, no, not right now, not under those conditions. Do you think you could sweeten the pot a little bit?" But then, you know, the Maidan putsch was launched, and, you know, it was obviously supported by the U.S. and the EU. I mean, there's no question about such things as Hromadske and stuff. They're quite open about their funding in it. Yeah. And the U.S. and the EU politicians who were parachuting into Kiev, right, cheerleading crowds, mostly from Western Ukraine, calling for the overthrow of the government, for revolution, and so on. And, you know, the Yanukovych government collapsed much faster than I believe Moscow or they expected it to, because it did have a lack of support even from its own base, much less from the west of the country.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that the east of the country looked forward to these people's seizing power. They had elected Yanukovych not because he was a great candidate, because he was the lesser of two evils, the same as any democratic vote in the country, to keep the other people from the West Ukraine out of power.
Right.
So the fact that they didn't love Yanukovych doesn't mean that they love the new bunch that seized power and then proceeded to, you know, wage a civil war, shelling their cities in East Ukraine to try to get them to accept the new seizure of power, which in Donbass, they still haven't done to this point. And Crimea took the advantage when Russia gave them the opportunity to jump ship. And, you know, full disclosure, my wife is Crimean, and I have family in Crimea and all across southeast Ukraine, Donbass, Kharkov, Odessa. Mm-hmm. And those are the viewpoints of the Ukrainian people whose parties have been banned, pogromed. And you know, completely left without political representation under this new regime, that you never are allowed to hear in the Western press. So that leads us up to then Syria, where Russia drew a red line against what is an obvious U.S. UK, France, Saudi, Qatar, and Turkey regime change attempt. And Russia drew a hard and fast line on Syria. And when Obama hesitated before going overt, when his proxy war wasn't doing the job, Russia snuck in, I believe prevented a a planned, it was quite obviously and openly, I mean, it was discussed in the pages of the Washington Post and so on, a Benghazi, Libya-style creeping regime change, beginning with a safe haven that would have been created north of Aleppo, where Turkish troops are now. And then it would, of course, you know, blown up into a no-fly zone, and then a no-fly zone into a bombing, you know, the country, the spree, and then, you know, into bombing Assad out of Damascus, which probably would have led to mass ethnic cleansing of Alawites, Shia, Druze, Christians, Syrian Christians, and others along the heavily populated coastal regions. So, you know, that brings us in, you know, to a close on the Obama administration with Russia's intervention looking more and more like it's succeeding in its goals. East Aleppo has been liberated from a grab bag of what should only be described as Al-Qaeda and friends. Obama has taken some Parthian shots going out the door. He made a lame attempt to increase some more sanctions against Russia, which doesn't really, they're mostly individually directed. They don't really bother anyone here. Signed legislation, a defense appropriation bill, which will allow Syria to be flooded with man pads, which I really hope for the sake of the, you know, the American people, the U.S. military there, and the entire region, that, you know, these man pads don't end up, as seems likely, in the hands of people who will use them for more overt terrorism later on, rather than just against Syrian and Russian military targets.
Right. I mean, we've seen that, you know, that you're talking in Europe and the United States, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, well, you know, planes, air carriers fly all throughout the world. Yes, they could be used anywhere. And it's not like we haven't seen enough terrorist attacks in Europe recently.
Right.
You know, many of which, you know, included refugees, quote unquote, from Syria and from Afghanistan and Iraq and across the region because of these repeated interventions. Then we also have the 2016 presidential campaign, no matter what you may think of it, and myself, I have of mixed feelings. And the Democrats have leveled charges that Russia has done what they claim that Russia did, what basically the U.S. has done repeatedly in countries around the world, including Russia, and interfered in its democratic political process. There were some attempts to try to claim that they actually hacked the vote itself. These were quickly dismissed as ridiculous. And when the recounts proved that actually Trump got more votes in some of these areas than they had originally forecast him with. But then the idea is that Russia is secretly behind WikiLeaks, and WikiLeaks exposed that, among other things, on the Clinton and Podesta emails and you know, the DNC, that essentially the Democratic National Primary was rigged. It was highly favorative and selective of Clinton over Sanders, and made a lot of attempts along the way to diminish Sanders in the press and have his you know, supporters, if not silenced, then have their platform, their megaphone taken away, and then Clinton elevated. And certainly this hurt Clinton among some leftists in the United States. And I think rightly so. This is blamed on Russia. And I think that the accusations that this are based on Russia are, well, the evidence is lacking. And it's not just me who says that. I mean, Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept says the same things. Jeffrey Carr, one of the cyber warfare and cybersecurity CEOs of the United States, whom I've conversed with, also agrees the evidence is just not there. What there is coincidental. Does Russia hack into U.S. political parties and so on? Yes, it does. And as the former NSA and CIA director Hayden spoke just a few months ago. Yes, and he considers that the honorable business that he does, because that's the exact same thing he does right. to Russia and elsewhere around the world.
Right.
Now, the question isn't, did Russia hack U.S. political? Did they then transfer this information to WikiLeaks with intent to change the U.S. Election? Because we also know that there were at least a dozen entities who had violated the DNC. And the idea that some of these were Russian based on entirely ridiculous things like they named themselves in their code Felix Dzerzhinsky, director of Soviet intelligence,
right.
the Czechists,
right.
and used Russian language. As some other hacks have revealed, when the U.S. wants to disguise its cyber warfare trail, it uses Russian and Chinese language
For sure.
in its code.
Right.
So all of the information is coincidental. And some of it is so glaringly obvious that even someone as anti-Russian as John Bolton says that it may be a false flag.
Yeah.
So whether they did or not, of course, part of the thing is to deflect and distract away from the substantive issues that are raised.
Right.
There are a number of things raised in those Clinton and Podesta emails, both in foreign policy. I think the far bigger ones are actually in foreign policy around Saudi Arabia and ISIS, and maybe that is better left for another discussion.
Right.
But domestically with the election and the DNC, certainly, I think the public had a right to know these things.
Well, just on the ISIS thing, just to make a very quick reference to it, what we're talking about is evidence of complicity by U.S. officials and particularly Democratic Party officials with ISIS.
Yeah, well, Clinton, citing U.S. intelligence, said that ISIS and al-Qaeda in Syria are armed and funded by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, U.S. governments that Clinton and Obama then went on to sell record arms sales of over $100 billion in jets and arms just to Saudi Arabia, and invite them into their anti-ISIS coalition when they know that Saudi Arabia and Qatar are arming and funding ISIS.
Right.
And that just makes the whole thing a ridiculous sham. I mean, we all suspected that, but this is them saying they know from their own intelligence. And what Clinton knew as Secretary of State, I think we can assume that Obama knew. And that really, I mean, the implications of that, the Western press just doesn't want to talk about it. They refuse to acknowledge that email exists. No one has ever seriously questioned its credibility or anything else provided by WikiLeaks.
Right.
It has to be said that WikiLeaks, for its part, says it wasn't provided by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a former British ambassador now associated with WikiLeaks said that he knows who gave the information because he was a participant in the handoff, that it was an inside leak from someone within the Democratic National Committee. It was not a Russian, and Russia had nothing to do with it. But all of this is by and large because whatever effect these leaks, whoever provided them had, Donald Trump was elected president. And I, for one, seriously don't believe they actually really impacted the votes of the white working class in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, myself being working class from Pennsylvania very much. Donald Trump is terrible. I mean, domestically, I find him frightening. Foreign policy, he actually offers me some rays of guarded, cautious, optimistic hope as a realist foreign policy. But, he should have been beaten by any serious Democratic candidate. And Democrats were just seriously in denial by how much, not just Republican, but independent white America did not like Clinton and did not like the legacy of the Clintons,
right.
and did want something. They wanted some kind of radical change. Obama was hope and change. Well, hope and change again. Maybe not hopeful this time. Maybe more negatively cast. Donald Trump was elected, by the Electoral College, and despite some media and Clinton attempts to try to get electors to switch their votes and provoke a constitutional crisis. Actually, more of the electors ended up voting against Hillary Clinton than, than voted against Trump, which was kind of a final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, you know, one of the things when you talk about the white working class in places like Pennsylvania, you know, finally, the deep analysis of the vote shows that people there, in fact, voted over the perception that Trump, because he said he would do it, which is something that no one else had done except Sanders, likewise, I'm going to get you a job. And they need jobs. And for some reason, it's inconceivable to the media and the pundits here that people would actually vote. People that are unemployed and desperate economically would vote on those interests.
And it must be said that I don't think he's going to give them jobs. I don't think anyone can. The globalization genie is out of the bottle. And from some interviews I've seen with them there, they don't even necessarily believe he's going to give them jobs. But at the very least, he spoke against the free trade agreements, NAFTA and others, that they know have cost them those jobs.
It killed them, too.
And perhaps that was enough in their minds. Yep. But yeah, I don't think Donald Trump is going to really help the white working class. I think one look at his cabinet, which is already the richest cabinet in history, between the billionaires and the neoliberals and the Goldman Sachs, you know, who populate it just as they populated Obama's economic team, and would have dominated Clinton's economic team as well. And I don't really expect anything there, but it as always with American politics, a lot of votes are simply cast out of spite. And I don't believe that Clinton necessarily would have helped the white working class any better. No. I don't know if anything can really help the white working class in the Rust Belt. Unfortunately, that might be
or the rest of the working class,
the rest of the working class, white or not, that really doesn't make a difference. It's a good point. Thanks for correcting me there. So Obama has taken a few Parthian shots out the door. We've heard accusations, insinuations from him. There's the idea, that the CIA has said that Russia did this, but actually the CIA hasn't said that at all.
Right.
What we have is an anonymous official quoted in the Washington Post, claiming to know what the CIA has said via consensus, which is not at all clear that there is in the CIA, over a secret report, which you're not allowed to see, that said that Russia may have done this. Right. And that is all a little fishy. And there's institutional wars between the CIA and the FBI going on, just like there were proxy wars in Syria going on between the CIA and the Pentagon.
I know.
My God, Obama can't control the institutions of his own government. For that alone, I'm glad to see him gone, even though I was one of the ones who voted for him the first time around and registered people by the hundreds to help get him elected. I was, deeply disappointed, in all of that. But that puts us off. Donald Trump is going to take office. These Parthian shots are not going to, all of this furor, I believe, over, from the CIA, this secret CIA, but the CIA didn't actually say it and talk. I believe it's an attempt to submarine any intended detente between an incoming Trump administration and Russia, something which I think is really to the not being a person who wants World War III over Syria, Ukraine, or anywhere else, I think is really to all of our benefits. If you say you don't want detente between two nuclear armed powers that are involved in several hotspots, I seriously question your sanity.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that that Trump is going to give in to Russia on everything, and Russia certainly doesn't expect that. They really don't know what to expect from Trump, but they're just perhaps a little glad that Clinton's not in office, but they don't really know where all of this is going either. This is an attempt to prevent any detente from taking place. How can Donald Trump institute a policy of detente when he's accused of literally, being a puppet of Putin?
Mark, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Don, thanks for having me. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Yep, talk to you next year.
Yes.
Yep. And that's all the news we have for you right now.
For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.